Welcome to the deep dive. You know, you probably interact with steel like dozens of times a day without even really thinking about it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all do.
Right. You drive over suspension bridges, you work in massive buildings held up by these hidden structural frameworks, you trust your life to the chassis of your car.
Yeah, and we look at all that steel and we just see this absolute immovable permanence, like it's just a dead, solid object.
Exactly. But if you zoom in, like way, way in, we realize that strength is actually a fragile illusion. It's highly engineered, constantly active, microscopic game of atomic Tetris.
It really is a completely different universe down at the atomic level. It's a universe of constant tension, microscopic architecture, and honestly, hidden battlegrounds that most people never even think about.
And that is exactly what our mission is for today's deep dive. We are exploring a fascinating detective story hidden within the world of metallurgical crystallography.
Yes, looking at the very building blocks of the metals we rely on.
Right. And today's stack of sources includes some pretty dense technical excerpts, plus detailed microscopy image analyses from vanadium carbide material science, and a few related texts. We're going to look at how a completely invisible microscopic structure prevents the modern world steel from suddenly and catastrophically shattering.
Which is a huge deal, but there's a twist,
Right,
right?
a massive twist. We're going to talk about how the world's top material scientists fundamentally misunderstood the identity of that very structure for decades. Okay, let's unpack this. Because while material science might sound a bit dry on the surface, it's actually this incredibly high-stakes world of atomic-level engineering.
It absolutely is. And to really grasp the scientific controversy we're going to get into later, we first have to understand what this hidden structure actually is.
Like what it's actively doing inside the metal we rely on every single day.
Exactly. And the material at the center of all this is called vanadium carbide.
Right. So setting the stage here for you listening, what does a vanadium carbide actually look like when we zoom in on the steel?
Well, when vanadium carbides form inside a phase of steel known as ferrite.
Which is, just to clarify, the standard room temperature crystalline structure of iron.
Yes, exactly. Good clarification. So in that ferrite phase, they don't just form random messy blobs. They precipitate out of the metal as these incredibly fine, perfectly square-shaped platelets.
Square
Yes,
platelets.
and we are talking unimaginably tiny here. They form on what we call the 100 alpha planes, and they are about 20 nanometers in length.
Okay, to put that 20 nanometers in perspective for you, a single human hair is roughly 80 to 100,000 nanometers wide. So these platelets are just vanishingly small.
They really are, and they align themselves along very specific diagonal fault lines within the iron structure. But if you heat the steel up, it shifts into a different structural phase entirely called austenite.
So a hotter, more densely packed environment.
Right, and in that environment, the vanadium carbide actually shapeshifts. Instead of tiny flat squares, they form as octahedral shapes on the 111 gamma facets.
Octahedral.
Yeah, imagine two microscopic pyramids basically stuck together at their flat bases.
Wow. So depending on the heat and the phase ferrite versus austenite, these things are shape-shifting between tiny flat squares and little microscopic pyramids. That is wild.
It's incredible.
But it really begs the question, why are they there?
Yeah.
I mean, did engineers put them there on purpose, or are they just some weird byproduct of making steel?
Oh no, they are highly intentional. And this is where we actually meet the true villain of our story.
A villain.
Yeah, diffusible hydrogen.
Diffusible hydrogen. I have to admit, that sounds almost harmless, like something you'd find in a high-end sparkling water or something.
I know, it sounds gentle, but it is anything but harmless. In fact, it's a silent killer of infrastructure.
Wait, really? How?
Well, hydrogen is the smallest element in the universe, right? Because its atoms are so incredibly tiny, they don't just bounce off solid steel, they diffuse.
Meaning they go right through it.
Exactly. They literally slip right through the solid iron lattice like a ghost walking through a brick wall. And this happens all the time during welding, electroplating, or even just through natural corrosion over time.
Okay, and once the ghost is inside the house, what happens?
Once inside, these wandering hydrogen atoms look for microscopic defects or tiny gaps in the steel's structure. And when multiple hydrogen atoms meet up in one of these little gaps, they combine to form hydrogen gas.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, this creates immense localized internal pressure. Eventually, that pressure forces the solid steel to crack from the inside out.
That's terrifying.
It is. It's a phenomenon called hydrogen embrittlement. It literally turns tough, flexible steel into this brittle, glass-like material that's prone to sudden, catastrophic failure.
So it sneaks in and essentially unzips the structural integrity from the inside out.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
So how do our tiny 20-nanometer square vanadium carbides fight back against this invisible ghost?
They fight back by creating what material scientists call coherency strain fields.
Coherency strain fields. Okay, break that down for me.
Here's how it works. The crystal lattice of the vanadium carbide doesn't perfectly match the crystal lattice of the surrounding iron. The carbide is actually just a little bit too big for the microscopic space it occupies.
Okay.
Because of this size mismatch, it physically stretches and strains the atomic bonds of the iron immediately surrounding it.
So it's kind of like taking a perfectly woven grid of fabric and forcefully shoving a slightly too large block into the middle of it. The grid lines bulge and stretch around the block.
Precisely. That bulging area, that stretched fabric, that is the strain field.
Got it.
And this localized tension does two crucial things for the metal. First, it makes the steel significantly harder by interrupting the easy sliding of atomic layers. But second, and honestly more importantly, it traps that rogue diffusible hydrogen.
Wait, how does tension trap a ghost?
Well, because the atomic bonds in that strain field are physically stretched open by the oversized carbide block, they create these slightly roomier microscopic pockets.
Oh.
So when a wandering hydrogen atom happens to pass near this stretched zone, it gets physically wedged into those slightly larger gaps. The tension just holds it there. It becomes energetically trapped.
So it's not like a sponge soaking up water, necessarily. It's more like a tightly stretched security net. Or like a microscopic snare trap.
A snare trap is a perfect analogy.
Yeah, the hydrogen is this rogue agent trying to wander around and cause structural damage. And these thousands of tiny distorted nets scattered throughout the steel just catch it, wedging it harmlessly in place so it can't gang up with other hydrogen atoms and crack the metal.
That is exactly the mechanism. The coherency strain field acts as a physical snare, using the tension of mismatched atoms to neutralize the hydrogen threat completely.
Okay, so if these particles are so utterly crucial for our infrastructure, I mean, if they are the literal snare traps holding our bridges and skyscrapers together, we must have them completely mapped out, right? We must know exactly what we are manufacturing.
You would certainly think so. But unfortunately, this is where the detective story gets its massive plot twist.
Oh.
For decades, the scientific community had the chemical identity of this life-saving structure completely wrong.
Wait, a decades-long case of mistaken identity on something this critical?
A monumental one. Going back to papers published in the late 1950s, the vanadium carbide precipitating in steel was universally thought to be a structure called V4C3.
V4C3, meaning four vanadium atoms for every three carbon atoms.
Correct. And crucially, it was believed to have a perfectly symmetrical cubic geometry. Think of a perfect rigid little box.
Okay.
With a lattice parameter of exactly 0.4157 nanometers. That was the established textbook truth for over 40 years. It was the absolute foundation for countless engineering models and interpretations in the scientific literature.
But I'm guessing it wasn't a perfect cube. What forced them to realize the textbooks were wrong? Because, I mean, you can't exactly put a steel I-beam under a high school microscope and check the geometry.
No, you definitely can't. But as transmission electron microscopy and electron diffraction patterns really advanced, researchers were finally able to see how electron beams scattered off the atomic layers.
Oh, so they could basically bounce beams off the atoms to see their shape.
Exactly. And when they looked closely at those scattering patterns, they realized the geometry was totally off. It wasn't a perfect cube at all, and it wasn't V4C3. It is actually V6C5.
Six vanadium to five carbon, which means the geometry has to be totally different to accommodate that new atomic ratio.
Completely different. It has what's called a monoclinic structure.
What does that look like?
Imagine taking that perfect rigid cubic box from the old textbooks and pushing down really hard on one of the top corners so the whole thing skews.
Like it becomes a slanted asymmetrical parallelogram.
Exactly. It becomes a slanted box. The new parameters are totally different. The A axis is 0.509 nanometers, the B axis is 0.882, and C is 1.018. That slight skew fundamentally changes how it locks into the surrounding iron.
Why is it skewed, though? Like, what actually makes it slant?
The slant happens because the V6C5 structure contains something called ordered vacancies.
Ordered vacancies, meaning empty space, like literal holes where a carbon atom should be but just isn't.
Yes. But they aren't random, accidental missing pieces. They are highly organized.
How so?
If you look at the atomic layers of this true structure, you see alternating planes. One plane has all of its carbon atoms perfectly in place. The next plane has specific, mathematically regular vacancies, empty holes. And this happens in an alternating, repeating pattern throughout the entire crystal.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second on behalf of the listener.
Go for it.
You're telling me this incredibly strong metal relies on literally nothing, on missing atoms. How does empty space make this snare trap work?
It sounds counterintuitive, I know.
And honestly, if the steel is already working, if the bridge is standing, why does it matter if we call it V4C3 or V6C5? Is this just academic hair splitting over a slanted box?
What's fascinating here is that the geometry dictates the physics. Those missing carbon atoms that empty space allow the surrounding vanadium and iron atoms to relax slightly inward, kind of collapsing into the hole.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That tiny microscopic collapse is what physically distorts the crystal. It creates the slant we talked about. And that slant is exactly what creates the perfect coherency strain field, the snare trap that catches the hydrogen.
So without the empty space, there is no snare.
Exactly. The empty space is actually doing the heavy lifting.
That is wild.
And as for why it matters, well, because modern engineers can't design next generation, stronger, lighter alloys if their mathematical foundation is wrong.
That makes total sense. If your baseline math is a cube, but reality is a slanted box, your safety margins are going to be completely warped.
Exactly. And because the entire history of material science literature was full of interpretations based on the old perfect cube model, scientists couldn't just say, oops, our bad, and move on. They had to actively translate 40 years of historical data.
Right, because if I'm an engineer trying to model how much stress a new suspension bridge cable can take, and I use the old math based on perfect cubes instead of the real math based on slanted boxes, my entire safety simulation is compromised.
Spot on. So to fix this, modern scientists had to develop complex mathematical conversion matrices. It's essentially a scientific translation dictionary.
I saw those matrices in the research for today's deep dive. They are intense linear algebra, just massive grids of decimals that you have to multiply old data against.
They are vital, though. Scientists literally have to recalculate classic orientation relationships.
What's an orientation relationship?
For instance, there is a famous rule in metallurgy called the Baker-Nutting orientation relationship. It describes exactly the angle and direction at which the vanadium carbide crystal locks into the iron crystal.
Sort of like how two specific, wildly different Lego pieces snap together. You have to know the exact angle, rotation, and position of the plastic studs, or they just won't fit.
That's a great way to put it. Under the old cubic assumption, the Baker-Nutting relationship was mathematically simple. The straight up and down axis of the carbide aligned perfectly with the straight up and down axis of the iron. Nice, clean, and totally wrong.
Right, because it's not a cube.
Under the true slanted reality, that relationship becomes highly complex. You are aligning a skewed parallelogram face against a cubic iron face. The angles are completely different. The new math proves the lock is much more complicated than we ever imagined.
Which brings up an incredible question about how we actually prove these things today. We mentioned electron microscopes earlier, but to see a missing atom, or to see exactly how these slanted Legos snap together, you need extreme methods.
You really do. You have to use unimaginable extremes. And this brings us to a specific groundbreaking study using an imaging atom probe conducted by a researcher named A.R. Waugh.
Right, and the photos in the source were provided courtesy of Dr. Sally Waugh. I love this part of the deep dive, by the way, because there's this sudden, very relatable human element dropped right into the middle of all this dense, high-level crystallography. It mentions a researcher simply named Bob.
Yes, Bob. So Bob wanted to investigate a very strange anomaly. Another researcher, P. Turner, had suggested that the boundary of these tiny vanadium carbide snare traps might not be a hard line.
Not a hard line, like it's blurry.
Well, Turner suspected there was a disturbance in the trajectories of the carbon atoms at the very edges of the particle.
So Bob and his team essentially set up a stakeout at the atomic level. They wanted to see if the carbon distribution actually bleeds out beyond the accepted borders of the carbide particle.
Exactly.
And to do this, they couldn't just use a standard microscope. They used an imaging atom probe on a mixed titanium-vanadium carbide particle. How does that probe actually work?
An imaging atom probe is a fascinating piece of machinery. You don't look through a lens. Instead, you take your steel sample and you sharpen it into a needle so incredibly fine that the tip is only a few atoms wide.
A needle a few atoms wide. Just wrapping my head around that.
It's extreme. Then you place that needle in a vacuum and apply a massive electrical field to it. The field is so strong that it literally rips the atoms off the tip of the needle one by one.
Wait, it tears the metal apart atom by atom.
Exactly. Those ripped off atoms, which are now electrically charged ions, fly through the vacuum and hit a specialized detector screen. By recording exactly where each ion hits the screen, computers can reconstruct a 3D map of the needle tip, literally atom by atom.
But there's a catch, right? Because atoms are constantly vibrating due to heat. If they are vibrating furiously when they get ripped off the needle, their flight path to the detector is going to be super erratic. You just get a blurry picture.
You hit the nail on the head. To stop that thermal vibration, Bob and his team had to run the specimen at 60 Kelvin. 60 Kelvin. Okay, for context, that is roughly minus 351 degrees Fahrenheit.
Unbelievably cold.
That is colder than the surface of Pluto. You are freezing the atoms practically to a dead standstill just to take their mugshot.
You have to if you want a crisp image of individual ions.
Uh-huh.
And the results were stunning. When they calibrated the probe to only look at the iron ions, so the steel matrix, the reconstructed image showed a dark, perfectly empty void right where the carbide particle was sitting.
So it's a perfect silhouette. It definitively proved there is no iron inside the carbide trap itself.
Right. But then they switched the calibration to look only at the carbon ions.
Mm.
And the image showed something incredible. The carbon trajectories didn't stop cleanly at the edge of the particle.
They bled out.
Yes. The carbon ions physically stretched outwards, extending into the surrounding iron lattice. Here's where it gets really interesting. It makes me think of a street lamp on a really thick, foggy night. You know exactly where the bulb is. The core of the light is solid and distinct, but the light, its influence, bleeds out into the fog, creating this blurry, fading halo.
I love that.
The carbon is bleeding out into the surrounding steel, blurring the physical boundary of the snare trap itself.
That is a phenomenal analogy. The boundary of the particle isn't a hard brick wall. The carbon's influence bleeds into the matrix. This visual confirmation completely revolutionized how we view the interface between the carbide and the steel.
It's not just a black and white border.
Exactly. It's not a binary border where steel ends and carbide begins. It's a dynamic transition zone. The snare trap is literally tethered into the surrounding iron by this halo of carbon.
It really highlights how alive this seemingly solid piece of metal is.
Mm-hmm.
And makes me wonder. We've been talking about standard vanadium carbide, V6C5,
right,
acting as a trap for hydrogen in everyday structural steel. But what happens when you push the industrial environment to the absolute physical extreme?
Like really heavy-duty applications.
Yeah. What if you were building something that makes structural steel look weak?
Then you have to turn to the extreme cousins of this material. The metallurgical texts introduce us to another variant entirely, V8C7.
Okay, V8C7. So we've gone from the mistaken cube of V4C3 to the slanted real-world reality of V6C5 and now V8C7. Where does this extreme cousin show up?
This specific variant occurs in highly specialized vanadium-rich steels. These are the types of alloys used to manufacture heavy-duty industrial dyes.
Dyes. So we're talking about the massive, brutal industrial molds and stamping tools that are used in factories to literally crush, cut, and stamp other pieces of solid metal into shape.
Exactly. They have to withstand immense repeated pressure, friction, and heat without warping even a fraction of a millimeter.
Right. To handle that level of violence, the internal atomic structure has to shift again, doesn't it?
It does. Unlike the skewed monoclinic V6C5, this heavy-duty V8C7 variant actually is cubic.
Wait, really? We're back to the cube?
We are. It forms a perfectly symmetrical lattice with a parameter of 0.832 nanometers. But crucially, this cubic structure only exists when it's carbon vacancies. Those empty spaces we talked about are perfectly ordered.
There are those ordered vacancies again. The strategic use of nothing?
Yes. And here's where it gets truly bizarre. If you heat this dye steel up to about 1125 degrees Celsius, it hits what is called its order-disorder temperature.
Order-disorder temperature. What happens then?
At that extreme heat, the empty spaces lose their strict alternating arrangement. They jumble up and become completely randomized. The crystal remains cubic, but because the nothingness is no longer organized, the fundamental lattice size of the entire crystal shrinks by half.
Wait, so the extreme heat literally forces the empty spaces to rearrange themselves, which completely alters the physical size and strength of the crystalline snare trap.
It does. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it shows us something profound. The macroscopic, real-world properties of a heavy industrial tool, like its ability to violently stamp out 10,000 car doors without shattering, are directly dictated by whether or not the invisible, empty spaces between its atoms are lined up correctly.
That is entirely mind-bending. The empty space is dictating the reality of the solid object.
It's poetry, really.
It is. And just to show how wild this atomic rulebook can get, the texts give us one final point of contrast. What happens if we ditch vanadium entirely and use a different metal, say tungsten?
Oh, tungsten carbide is a completely different animal.
Yeah.
When you swap out the vanadium atoms for tungsten atoms, making WC the entire crystal structure, abandons both the cubic and the slanted monoclinic shapes entirely.
What does it become?
It becomes hexagonal. Specifically, it falls into the P6m2 space group.
So just by changing one single elemental ingredient in the recipe, the entire geometric blueprint goes out the window, and you get a hexagonal structure instead.
Yes. It really emphasizes how custom-tailored these alloys have to be. Every single atomic choice totally rewrites the architectural rules of the metal.
And consequently, rewrites the mathematical translation dictionaries required to understand them.
Exactly. It's a constant evolution of our scientific understanding. We move from assuming a simple, clean cube to discovering a slanted structure relying on ordered empty space to mapping bleeding carbon halos at -351 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's an incredible journey.
Yeah.
So let's synthesize what we've unpacked today in this deep dive.
Let's do it.
We started by looking at microscopic snare traps, these 20 nanometer vanadium carbide platelets sitting inside our everyday steel. We learned that by physically stretching the atomic bonds of the iron around them, they create coherency strain fields that trap wandering, diffusible hydrogen.
Right, preventing it from turning the steel brittle and destroying the structural integrity of our world.
Then we explored how, for over 40 years, the scientific community misidentified the very geometry of the structure, saving our steel. They assumed it was the mathematically simple cubic V4C3.
When in reality, it was the skewed monoclinic V6C5, powered by alternating planes of strategically missing carbon atoms.
We saw the mathematical gymnastics, those intense conversion matrices that modern engineers have to use as a translation dictionary to fix decades of historical data, like recalculating the Baker-Nutting orientation relationship.
Which is no small feat.
Definitely not.
Uh-huh.
We look through the lens of an atom probe, ripping atoms off a frozen needle just to see the blurry street lamp halo of carbon trajectories tethering the trap to the steel. And finally, we looked at how extreme industrial manufacturing relies on the perfectly ordered empty spaces of V8C7 to maintain its immense strength.
This whole saga raises an important point about the nature of material science itself. It is never a closed book. We look at a steel beam and think we know everything about it. But the closer we look, the more complexity we find hidden in the empty spaces.
So what does this all mean for you? Next time you drive over a steel bridge or look up at the exposed beams of a skyscraper, I want you to think about that invisible atomic game of Tetris holding it all together.
Keep the hydrogen ghosts in mind.
Think about those snare traps, exactly. But more importantly, consider this. If a material as foundational to our modern civilization as steel relied on a fundamental scientific misunderstanding of its microscopic structure for decades, with literal empty space doing so much of the heavy lifting, what other mistaken identities are currently hiding in plain sight in the solid, everyday materials surrounding you right now?
It definitely makes you wonder what else we accept as absolute fact simply because we haven't looked closely enough or coldly enough yet.
Exactly. Thank you for coming along on this deep dive with us. It's a great reminder that the best insights and sometimes the most profound mysteries are often hidden in the smallest details. We'll see you next time.